Hi, I'm Matthew Horton, Arnold Porter. I do intellectual property law, and I want to talk to you guys today about some of the issues that you might face in how you go about working with your counsel to prepare different forms of intellectual property protections. I understand that walking around here, we have different flavors of companies and people are from different types of entities that have varying levels of sophistication when it comes to the IP protection or IP programs that they have. So I'm trying to, I'll try to gear it towards folks who are at very large entities that have very sophisticated IP programs and how you can work with them. And then, of course, talk about those of you who are with mid-level or startups and how you might get something going. okay, so key themes and takeaways needed to prepare this for the conference. Conference organizers, we can run through this later. But the bottom line I think you guys want to take away from this is that it's your engagement with your IP program is going to be about getting out in front of the projects that you're working on, getting out in front of disclosures. Trying to make sure that you are taking an affirmative hand in identifying the inventions that might be available to you instead of taking an approach that is more passive or more, hey, I think I have an idea here. It is more of a, okay, here's the project we're going to be preparing. Here's our whatever development techniques you guys might employ. Here's where we're going to put in our reviews of potential IP opportunities. and then, of course, I just highlight the last two points there, that open source, I know everyone in here is going to be using open source in some way, shape, or form. It does not preclude your IP protections. It's just something else, another piece of complexity that you have to consider, but it does not preclude them at all. And then, of course, software patents are not dead quite yet, but we have to nuance that a little bit, which I'm sure is a topic of interest for many people. Okay, so let's move on to our types of intellectual property. Just breeze through the basics of intellectual property law for everyone. There are basically four different types of IP that are of interest. You've got your trademarks, which... trademarks, patents, trade secrets, copyrights. So trademarks and trade dress, that's essentially the logos, the names of the companies, this kind of thing. They protect, many people think that they're supposed to be protecting the company in some way. The theory of it is that it actually protects the public's association with a particular product, which I understand that can be a fine distinction. But the ultimate purpose is to make sure that when I see something, a product on a shelf that says Coca-Cola, I, as a consumer, identify that as being with that particular company. And so we want to make sure that that's what's protected. This will really only come into play for you guys when we're talking about different types of open source licenses that have the ability, more permissive licenses, for example, will let you make any kind of changes and modifications to code, but if you do that, you need to make sure that you remove trademarks for the company that put it out there. trade secrets, these are essentially any kind of idea whatsoever or sort of knowledge that you have that is, it's valuable because it is a secret. Examples include, a really common example would include like mailing lists, sort of phone directories, this kind of thing that someone might put together. Soft drink recipe, everyone knows the Coca-Cola anecdote, the Coca-Cola recipe. and then, of course, as you collect up data on your customers and consumers, that is all trade secret information. You get it by simply keeping it a secret. I know that is sort of redundant or kind of folds back in on top of itself, but you have to essentially keep it a secret, and then later on, if you want to enforce the fact that somebody stole it from you, misappropriated it, you have to show that, hey, we did what we could to keep this thing a secret. Okay, so copyrights and then next is patents. The copyrights, the goal is to protect the expression of an idea, not the idea itself. The way this works with a lot of what we do here is going to be primarily in the form of the code, the binaries, the compiled binaries, all your libraries. And that includes after compilation. It also includes whenever you move something from one piece of memory to another. That implicates copyright law because that is a copy of what was compiled, loaded into instruction memory, then pulled over to the CPU. Those are all copies of the same piece of the same work. Then we also have GUIs. GUIs, anything as, you know, anytime you have that you run the program, bring it up, every one of those screens are subject to their own copyright. Now they're automatic. The way you get a copyright itself is automatic. You just have it as soon as you have, well, the fancy word for it is fixation. In other words, once you write it down. One of the problems, I worked with a lot of musicians in New Orleans who would, after Katrina, stand out on the corner and they would just play music extemporaneously, play their jazz. Now, the problem was is companies would come in, or big production companies would come in and record those songs and play them on their television shows. And there's no copyright in that because there's no fixation. All they had to do was write the songs down, and that's it. They now have their copyright. So of course, with you guys, when as you code and as you design, put together all of your network charts, architecture charts, these kinds of things, those are all fixation. And you have that, the copyright is embodied inside of that. No further steps are needed. Now, what about registration with the Library of Congress? What that does is it merely gives you the right to enforce the copyright, but you have the copyright without the registration. And so the Library of Congress is just saying, okay, great, submit to us, you know, copies of it, of whatever it is you want to copyright. With a lot of large source code projects, that just means that there's, you submit sort of abbreviated or abridged versions of the code. Copyright offices, been working with large companies for decades now on how to submit those kinds of things. Okay, patents. So, and I know this is probably the most interesting subject for most folks, or same touchiest. These are supposed to protect inventive ideas, or these days we're ebbing more towards the inventive application of those ideas. So where conventionally it's just the thought is that your widget, right? We all like to have the idea of the garage inventor. So what we're looking at now is when we have a device, a piece of hardware, or some sort of code that might drive the behavior of the device itself. Firmware, for example, might be patentable. But the idea, of course, is that you are protecting the idea of a particular piece of machinery. Now, or a method, the method by which the machine functions. A common misconception with patents is that they give you the right to practice your invention. I think an interesting nuance or an important nuance to understand is that what they are, it's actually you have the right to exclude somebody. So what that means is you have these, you have this claim that say, here are the boundaries of my patent protection. Now, I don't have to do anything with that. I don't have to sue anybody, of course, but anybody's allowed to use these things. But I don't necessarily have the right to practice my invention because I might have and necessarily have incorporated in somebody before me their invention into mine. Which makes sense, right? We build, I mean, it's an iterative process, the patent system, right? And so just because I have a patent doesn't mean I get to actually practice my invention. It just means that I built on the ideas of others, which is great. So you still may have to go and get the license for certain components of your invention from somebody that preceded you. The way, of course, you get a patent is you file a patent application at the USPTO, or, of course, abroad, whichever jurisdiction you might want to go to, and you go through a process of examination, which these days is getting shorter, but can still take, typically, I think we're on an average of about 4 years or so to get it. There are different mechanisms to expedite that process. If you pay a fee, you expedite it. I hear rumors of people getting them in as short as 8 months. But of course, I think that's more of a strategic consideration. How important is it for us to get this out into the market, get our patent issued because we have a competitor in the market, for example? Okay, real quick, the enforcement mechanisms just for your self-enrichment. There are four sort of key ways that patents, intellectual property comes under scrutiny by some kind of judicial tribunal, right? And when you get into litigation, the first is the PTAB, the Patent Trials and Appeal Board, created in 2012 under the America Invents Act. It is simply a process within the PTO itself, where a panel of administrative patent judges, who are patent law experts, typically have some kind of familiarity or expertise with the technology, will take a look at what the examiner did during prosecution, take a look at the claims, and say, okay, is this something that should have issued in the first place? So it becomes a very quick and comparatively less expensive way if you are sued to turn around and attack that patent in the PTO instead of in court. Now, so that's a segue into federal courts. In federal courts, you're accused of infringement. Someone brings your infringement suit. There's a second sort of simultaneous suit that goes on where you sue back, you counterclaim for invalidity. So what the PTAB does is it gets rid of that sort of second suit, and you can sort of pull that out and take it over to the PTO because this can be beneficial in many instances because the PTAB judges will usually be more familiar with patent law, whereas a judge in some districts around the country, you know, it's 50-50 whether they were a labor attorney before they became a federal judge. Who knows, right? And maybe they have absolutely no idea what Hadoop is, right? So you're trying to explain to them big data analytics. So you take this over to PTAB, that invalidity portion of the suit, and try to invalidate there. Now, of course, you can leave it in the federal court as well. And what the federal court, this is your typical jury trial, this, you know, what we're all accustomed to on TV. They'll put in front of a jury whether you infringed and whether or not the patent is invalid. Now, the remedy you get in the PTAB is going to be the patent's invalidated or, for that matter, gold-plated. That is that, look, the PTAB and the examiner said, this thing is fine. So now you have this patent that is gold-plated, essentially, and you're really going to have difficulty invalidating it later on. In the federal court, the remedies are going to be either they grant, you know, you win, you lose, whatever, there's a monetary exchange, and the patent is either validated or invalidated. and, of course, from there, you can appeal to all the different appellate mechanisms. The next is the ITC. The ITC is another sort of administrative agency. Its purpose is to protect against importation of infringing products. Primarily, this is going to be patents and trade secrets. It's a very streamlined process as well. And it also makes determinations of infringement and validity of a patent, or for that matter, the scope of the protection associated with, say, a trade secret. But if you win, if a plaintiff wins in the ITC, they won't get a dollar value. What they'll get is an injunction by ICE and CBP, Border Patrol, to prevent importation. And so this is something that's usually used against a lot of the whenever one of the accused infringers is an Asian country or a European country, where that's where the manufacturing occurs. State courts, this is going to be less interesting because the majority of IP law focuses around federal law, but trade secrets will usually go, can go to state court. If somebody tries to steal something, this is why, for example, a lot of California case law is pretty robust on trade secrets because of the concentration of talent there. Has a discussion about when an employee leaves company A to go to company B, and so you see a lot of case law, a lot of a more robust trade secret law going on in places like California and Texas. But of course, usually those are going to come with an attendant patent infringement claim or copyright infringement claim, which is why those primarily end up in a federal court or a federal tribunal. Okay, so speaking specifically now to patent acquisition, the patent prosecution process, and what that looks like and how engineers can help. So there are four primary portions of a patent, so that when you're reviewing these things with your counsel, you sort of have an idea of what you're looking at, right? You have this background, which is this idea of, here are all the technologies that we had before and why the technologies failed. Okay, here's the detailed description. It essentially boils down to a white paper of what your invention is. Actually, oftentimes, we'll get a white paper from a professor or inventor and sort of convert it into the legalese that's necessary to broaden up the protection. But generally, what you're looking for there is a description of your invention in such a way that another colleague of yours, somebody else, can come along, read the patent, and practice it themselves. They can actually do what it is that you're describing there, and for that matter, what you've claimed as the boundaries of your invention. I know a lot of folks say that's kind of a ridiculous standard, this idea of enablement and what needs to be said in the detailed description, because many of them almost seem indecipherable. Well, I mean, that I have seen that. I understand that. That can be frustrating. The purpose of all of that language is to broaden up the protection itself. But no doubt there are some difficult-to-decipher patents out there. Okay, claims. The claim section is your most important part. That is actually, if you think of your plat for your property, that's the boundaries, the four corners of what you own, that's your claims. Oftentimes, the conversations surrounding patent law, or for that matter, the times that you're reviewing your work product with an inventor, you're saying, okay, let's take a look at these claims, let's take a look at the patent we wrote. What do we think? What's the quality of it? Are there any changes we need to make? In that conversation, as well as general conversation about patent law, oftentimes there's a miscommunication about what the patent is about, or for that matter, what the patent talks about or covers is disjointed from what the actual legal protection afforded by that patent is. Because what the protection of the patent is found inside of the claims and not in the detailed description. So I can describe any number of things inside of the detailed description. And it can cover things that we might all say, we might agree in this room, that we don't want to have patented, right? We might agree that, no, that's just entirely too broad. You're just trying to patent smiling. But when you actually take a look at the claims, it's more likely than not that what's claimed is significantly narrower and usually has some sort of functional application or embodiment into it. So it's important to make sure that when you're looking at these things and considering what your protection is or what protection you want, make sure you consider it in the claims. Okay, so what is patentable? There are four pieces or tests or things to consider about what you can protect and what patents are going to get through the patent office. And those are going to be patent eligible subject matter, which is the hot button issue right now in the computer science world, right? What is it that we should be able to patent? What is patentable? I think those two things are distinct because I think the law is a little bit disjointed from what should be patentable. Of course, we can probably pull this entire conference and get many different opinions on this, almost probably one for every head in the conference. But in any event, you're sort of assessing, okay, is this a machine? Is it a process that is executed by a machine? Is this a product of manufacture? Is this something that we actually are going to see on a shelf, or is this something that a professional or a machine is going to practice. So that's sort of the first threshold test. Is it one of those things? There's a fourth one, it's composition of matter, but I don't think we're doing too much chemistry in here. So we ask that question, and then we have these ideas of these exceptions to patent law, right? And so we say, okay, we have this machine, we have this method of operation or execution, but we don't think that we want this patent to issue because the way in which the claims are formulated, they are actually patenting big data analytics. You know, they're not patenting anything that the system is doing specifically to facilitate big data analytics. They're not doing anything to speed up the process. There's nothing special about the machinery or the algorithm or anything like that. It just boils down to, if I read these claims, we have to say that, yeah, that's great. It's a method. But there's an exception here in that you're actually just claiming so broadly, your layer of abstraction of what your claims say, you're just trying to claim big data analytics. And so we have these ideas. We have these exceptions to what's patentable. And the other ones that sort of fall in there is laws of nature, right? Lightning. Can't claim lightning. Right? We can't claim an equation itself, which of course gets frustrating for a lot of the older patents that we've dealt with when we talk about equations, because you might see the mathematics inside of the patent or even inside of the claim. And almost immediately when I see mathematics in a claim these days, and this isn't across the board, but generally when you see that, it's almost a certainty that patent might fail. There are exceptions to that, of course, but usually these days you'll see a judge who'll look and say, you're actually just claiming the math. Exceptions to that, I think, can fall into when that's part of a manufacturing process, like how much rubber do we put inside of this particular tire that we're banking? Well, we have an equation for that, and the equation drives the behavior of the machine. But there's a tangible output for that, which is different than in big data analytics, where we don't actually get a thing from it. We actually don't even see what the results are by design. We just get an output. Okay, so the next two sort of concepts we're looking at, one is prior art. What do we already know? We have these two fancy words for it, anticipation and obviousness. They boil down to what was known in the art, right? What was the state of the art at the time you filed your patent application? We say, okay, you have to enable, the prior art has to enable all of the elements of your claim. Okay, can someone pick up this patent over here, read it, and practice your claims? Right, it's a dead on. They've already disclosed it. Sorry, that's rare to see that. The more frequent one, of course, is obviousness. If I take a look at a couple of different things, is there, a couple of different references? This patent, this white paper, this conference presentation. Can I put that together in a way that means that really suggests what you've arrived at, and you really didn't add anything to it? You just kind of stitched together things that we already knew about. And the last one is a description of your invention. These are formality requirements. This usually rests on the head of your attorney. But the way that developers are going to be involved in that is to make sure that your colloquy, your back and forth, you're working with your counsel to really stitch together a very nice story about why your technology is an improvement to the art. And I'll get into the storyboard, story idea a little bit more. But you're going to have to play into this portion here in this last section here at 112 by making sure that you're really giving the detailed information that the attorneys need in order to what's called support the claims. In other words, look, I can read the patent. Every one of the elements is going to be supported in some way. Claim, I can point to somewhere in the patent where a claim element is found. Okay, so the prosecution process and how we start getting into a little bit of strategy here and how this might work with developers. So our first step we're talking about here is going to be, you guys are doing your work. You might be various areas of your various different stages, right? You might actually be coding. You might actually be, maneuvering around some of the different portions of your system, reconnecting things, whatever. And as you're sort of gaming that out, or while you're in action, you're going to want to say, okay, what are we improving upon? What are we doing to make, what changes are we making to our system as it stands? What are the technological hurdles we have? So we have these ideas of this concept of an invention mining meeting, which is essentially when everyone gets together, either within your team or with council, and you say, here's a new project we're going to implement. Here's a new product we've developed. Here's a new design for our system, right? Here's what the hurdles are. So what we want, we think we might be able to protect is here, here, and here. And you're going to do that regularly. You can schedule regular meetings with your council to do that, those kinds of mining meetings. And you'll be able to identify an inventory. You'd be amazed how many potential inventions you might be able to patent out of that, let alone the kinds of things you might identify for the purposes of copyright and trade secret. I think it's also important to do those for the purpose of identifying what might be trade secret, because you might say, hey, look, we had to come up with these solution sets. Now, they may not be patentable, but nobody else has actually resolved, fixed this bug in this way. Nobody has, nobody has an API like this, what have you. And so let's first consider whether or not we can patent it, and if not, let's contemplate whether or not it's something that we want to hold back for publication, maybe not put it out in an open source, just keeping it to ourselves. We also have invention disclosure forms. Anytime you identify a new thing that you have, solved the problem on the fly, what have you, you just put together an invention disclosure form. Usually they're templated, but it makes it very easy for you as developers, and to sort of work with council without having to, you know, stand up, go to their office, schedule a meeting, what have you. You can just say, here's a technical challenge I overcame. Here's the resolution. Here's a solution I came up with. A little bit of detail on what might be what might exist out there. And here you go, right? And now the impact on your day and on your life is actually quite minimal at that point, because now council can just sort of get that email, take a look, and see what he or she wants to do. But the idea is, of course, like many things in the universe, right, if you're doing these things incrementally, the impact on your day, the impact on the bottom line budget and time is going to be much lower, and the legal risks that you're going to run are going to be much more mitigated, as in, for example, disclosing something unintentionally, and now you've given up your ability to protect it. So you really want to get out ahead of these things. We've started this new project. Let's mine. I've made this fix, this solution. Let me put together an invention disclosure form. Now we can put together an inventory. Now within your own development teams, it would probably be beneficial to you guys to actually have an inventory of things that you have identified for potential patenting or otherwise, other IP protection, whatever it may be. This will help you. I have found, and this is, I think, many IP attorneys will tell you, that teams that sort of are aggressive about trying to put together their IP strategy end up identifying a lot more, not just IP that they have, but a lot more problems they've solved. It really becomes a mechanism of sort of whiteboarding, ideation, if you use the fancy terms going around these days, is you see the wheels turn as you're asking inventors questions about these things. Okay, what did you do? Well, so they show up and they want to say, oh, well, I came up with this solution and it does this. It resolves this one single problem, right? And once you start digging into it, well, who else do you have? Who are our competitors, right? What did you have to do to connect this circuit to this circuit? Who else does something like that? Maybe not direct competitors, right? What other products exist on the market? And what happens is deer trails, both good ones, and of course we all have bad deer trails, but you start to see forks appear where your IP protection can go broader and branch out into other marketplaces that you may not be thinking of going, and then also informing the direction of your own coding in your own development. You start to say, oh goodness, didn't consider that. That is something that we could probably protect. That is something that that's a feature we might actually include into our next release. So those mining meetings, those strategies, that inventory, if you're doing those things on a regular interval, once a quarter, you know, every 6 months, doesn't require, you know, you don't have to be aggressive. If you're out in front of those things, you'll find that you'll end up with more IP and a more relevant product, as well as additional products and additional ways to monetize your IP. Okay, so if we go to our strategy and review, now we have things that we may have identified as potential inventions. Companies will have tech panels, legal panels that will take a look at the either the inventory you produced or each of the IDFs. Maybe you run a prior art search to try to control costs. Maybe you don't. Maybe you just submit the application to the PTO. That's usually a strategic conversation with your counsel. They're less and less common these days. So much stuff is just so iterative that you just sort of say, okay, well, let's give it a shot, see what happens. But there are any number of factors that weigh into whether or not you want to conduct your prior search before you submit. Any other types of IP besides patents that you could derive from your inventory, that's always worth considering. And then, of course, update your inventory to reflect that. Now we go to our new applications. We go to our patent counsel. You'll sit down with them. You'll have, if you didn't already go through it, in your invention mining meeting, you'll disclose how the invention works. And you want to detail that story. Here's what was going on in the industry at the time. Here's what we're going to do to improve upon it. And here's how ours actually works, why people can't do it, why this is something that is more than just the abstract idea of XYZ. Here's why it's impossible for a human to do this thing. Now we'll draft and file the application. There'll be a back and forth. You'll probably see one or two drafts from your patent counsel. They'll ask for your input on it. I know that's a bear. I know that can be very, very tough. But again, if we've been documenting along the way, you'll start to see your own words and your own language reflected back at you. So it makes it a much more, not just cohesive application, but a much less painful experience in reviewing the application. It almost becomes a sort of a rubber stamp of sorts. Now we go to prosecution. PTO will say, okay, they'll examine it. You'll get office actions, which are essentially your rejections or allowances. You'll be involved in many instances if it's particularly a sophisticated issue, or if the examiner's just not getting it, and so you have to, you know, hey, look, examiner, can you talk to the inventor over here? Like, maybe they can provide a better detail here. Oftentimes, I find that examiners, especially in the particular art units, as they're called, that deal with technology, they just seem to be more open to talking to the developers instead of the attorneys. We get mired sometimes in the case law and the legal issues and the particular semantics of the words. But when they hear it from a developer, all of a sudden you lift a veil on that and they just say, hey, oh, okay, I get it. You're changing the world. This is great. And even though could have used the same language a month earlier for whatever reason. So that might be something that you might get involved with. Of course, then you get an allowance once you get the patent through. The claims have been adjusted, amended, what have you, to the examiners, to however the examiner appreciates it. And so there you have it. You now get your patent. You'll update your inventory, and then you realign your strategy, either the development strategy itself or, for that matter, any kind of IP strategy that you might have associated with that. Maybe you do pursue those deer trails, or maybe you decide, no, that's just something for another day, or that's just not interesting to us now. Okay, so how we help with the patent prosecution: be aggressive about submitting your IDFs whenever you overcome a technical hurdle. Schedule those regular mining meetings. Be clear and articulate in your state of the state of the art, the problem, and the solution when you're discussing things with counsel. Documentation. Developers, I mean, it's a way that developers have to live, right? We all have to use anytime our methods and functions, we got to make sure that we're documenting. So it's just the way it works. We be sure that you can sort of capture that in a way that a lay patent attorney can understand it, just convert it into something that they can comprehend. But you're doing it anyway, so it really makes things very easy for everyone to put together a nice patent application, but then also informs as you go through your prosecution process and you're having conversations with examiners, and make sure that you're not walling off a direction of your, a scope of protection that you don't want to wall off, right? You might say, oh, well, let's make this amendment. If the examiner calls, and they do this all the time, hey, if you just add this limitation on your protection, that's fine. Nobody's done that before. Let's narrow the claim. Let's add words. Fine. You know, and it's often the case that in-house counsel, outside counsel will just say, hey, that gets us through. That gets us a patent. That puts another patent in the portfolio. That's wonderful. In some instances, that might not be desirable. Okay. So, patent lifecycle, development, prior search, drafting, any kind of litigation, of course, the commercialization and monetization, I think we'll skip that for today. That's for other folks. Okay, more broadly, why develop an IP portfolio? I think it's pretty clear why we want to do these things. You know, they give you a good economic value for all the reasons they do, right? Licensing, infringement costs, this kind of thing. Barriers to entry, they become a block. Even if you were to file for copyright or for a patent, it has the effect of publication, which can, even if you don't get the patent or if your copyright is razor-thin protection, it's still published, so now you block somebody else from being able to get a patent on that. Likewise, of course, if you actually get the patent or the copyright truly issued to you, and it's a good, strong copyright, it actually is a function, functions as a barrier to entry. Insurance policy, of course, company goes belly up, what have you, business arm changes, your company pivots, hey, here's a way and we can recoup some costs, monetizing it in some way. Also, it really does inform your immediate engineering needs and more broadly, the direction of the company. Bullet points for review later if anybody's interested. Here's some great directions or ideas for developing your strategies. Tiered approaches to valuing an IP idea. This is one I really favor. Sort of take a look and say, okay, here's the directions we want to go with the company and our products, but here's here's what we're going to do. These are the most important. These are two. These are three, however you want to tier them out. That informs how much you want to spend when outside counsel gives you a quote on a particular office action response that for a patent application that's been sitting for 2 or 3 years or more or longer. And, you know, do we really want to keep spending on this? Well, this is our tier one. We have to get it. Spend. This was a vanity project for this particular developer who's not even with the company anymore. No, just let it die. Abandon it. IV review panels, technical review, I think that's important. Legal review, is this something, and strategy review, is this actually something we want? And then the last one I think that's worth mentioning is submission targets for groups is helpful, or for people. Those are targets. I'm not saying you have to have a stick and a carrot. And the last one, of course, that I think is worth mentioning is a thicket in an area. If it's a particular area you want to populate, it's great to sort of elbow into that and sort of set up a lot of good barriers, blocking for others to get in there as well. Engineers can help documentation, identifying anytime you overcome a problem. It's becoming sort of a theme here. You know, conduct those meetings, submit those IDFs. You find a problem, you find a solution, let someone know. And that's, I think, what you want to do. developer documentation. So disclosures and secrecy, I think, is something we need to mention as well. Make sure that if you guys disclose something ahead of the time that you've talked to a counsel, you could very easily end up rendering something unpatentable. or you just put it out there in the world. For that matter, if you do that and someone comes along and yeah, we have some things, controls in the U.S. that allow us to go back and sort of clean that up if we've disclosed something before we filed a patent application, that's great. But what if somebody hears that, goes off, and practices it anyway? Well, we still have a couple of years or so until we get our patent application issued. So, you know, it's important to make sure that you file before you disclose it. It could be, disclosure can be, it's actually has a very broad meaning. So just about anything that puts it out into the world. NDAs usually protect that. So make sure you're disclosing something, application's filed, or the person you're talking to is protected by an NDA. Let me see. Okay, so here's some common pitfalls. Disclosing before meeting with counsel. Assumptions and cultural views of IP protection. So many times I've been talking to developers and it's just, oh, well, we use open source, so we don't have much. Now, look, I have no question that many developers have a great grasp of open source licenses and how those function. They just do. And that's great. But it doesn't mean that necessarily that every possible avenue for protecting your invention, your direction, whether you're using open source or not, doesn't mean that's precluded. You can get in there. You can try to find something. Now, the something might not be worth pursuing. That's fair. You know, your strategy might not say that's what we want to go for, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it doesn't exist. So it's still worth evaluating, even if you use an open source shop. withholding information from the PTO, something's out there. You want to make sure that you're getting all the information that you know, that you've learned about this thing to your counsel. I would be certain and careful to, you don't have a duty to actually go and research, but make sure anything that you know about, get that to counsel. Make sure you don't have any problems later on. So, and I think the last one, of course, is, as I'd mentioned, when folks jump companies, there's sort of this issue of, what trade secrets have I taken with me? Because it's in your head, right? When you're coding, you're coding. And this, of course, was one of the key issues at first in Waymo, Uber. Of course, when it came out eventually that they downloaded 9 gigs of data to take it with them. That kind of went against the idea of we just knew how to do it. You took 9 gigs of data, but nevertheless, that is something to be careful of. That you are cognizant of what's in your head, what you worked on, and what you'll be working on at your new company. Make sure you talk about these things with counsel at both places, your old company and your new one. So. I want to open it up to questions, but I think I'm running low on time. I wanted to run through some interesting issues, but I think the key one that most people are going to be interested in here is going to be the patentability of software. And essentially what that boils down to is there was a key case that came up not long ago called Alice v. CLS Bank. And essentially what the decision was that, look, we have this idea of being able to patent these certain ideas of machines and methods of operation, as I mentioned, but we have these exceptions to it. So the Supreme Court said, okay, great. Well, what we're going to look at is whether or not you have, whether or not your claims have an abstract idea, not what's described in the patent, but what's claimed. Is it an abstract idea? Is it directed to? Now, people argue about that ad nauseum because the Supreme Court did a terrible job of explaining what that means. But nevertheless, we sort of say, okay, well, what were similar things that were described as abstract ideas? In the Alice decision itself, in that case, it was basically a piece of software that just did hedging. And there was nothing to it. It just was essentially just laid out steps of hedging. So, when you're talking to counsel about these things, you want to make sure that, and when you're reviewing these things, don't censor for counsel. Give them all the information they need. But and you can get these things through the patent office, but something that you can think about when you're disclosing is, hey, look, is this something that can be done by a human? Are there technical challenges, technical solution to a technical problem that I've identified? Is this something that I can bring to them? what is it that, it's a question of abstraction, right? Like most things that developers work with. Are you claiming internal combustion, or are you claiming the spark plug? And that becomes the question for council. So developers, your goal, your plan should be to work with council to identify, tell that story of why your system can't be done by a person and why it's an improvement to the technology that already exists. I'll be around. I think that's it. I'll be around if anybody has any questions. I know that I've already had a number of questions about this particular issue. So, all right.